Meaning of Marxism by Paul D'Amato. Section. The Importance and Limits of Unions. The working class cannot achieve even the most minimal advance without organizing. The bosses have their civic organizations and their manufacturers' associations, and they have at their disposal a centralized state apparatus. Workers must have their own organizations if they are to fight back. The most elementary form of workers' organizations is the union. Unions are training grounds that give workers confidence in their own collective power of resistance. They are the first line of defense for workers against attempts by capitalists to continually push down wages and conditions to their lowest possible level. Unions, to quote Eugene Debs, have been a moral stimulus as well as a material aid to the worker, promoting the class-conscious solidarity of the working class. Marx defended the importance of unions, but he also pointed out their limitations. Trade unions, he wrote, work well as centers of resistance against the encroachments of capital. However, quote, they fail generally from limiting themselves to a guerrilla war against the effects of the existing system, instead of simultaneously trying to change it, instead of using their organized forces as a lever for the final emancipation of the working class, the ultimate abolition of the wage system. End quote. Unions seek to change the terms of wage slavery, not abolish it. The way unions are organized mirrors this reality. First of all, unions don't organize workers as an entire class, but by their particular crafts or industries. Unions, therefore, overcome some of the divisions imposed by capitalism, but they also reflect these divisions. Unions require a full-time officialdom whose job is to negotiate with the employers. These leaders may come from the ranks, but their social position changes. Union officials no longer work and experience the same hardships as the workers they represent. Their salary is dependent on members' dues and is generally higher, in some cases a lot higher, than the workers they represent. Paradoxically, an organization created to advance workers' interests produces a leadership that can sometimes be a break on the struggles that are necessary to advance those interests. The German revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg, writing more than 100 years ago, summed up the general outlook of this layer. Quote, the specialization of professional activity as trade union leaders, as well as the naturally restricted horizon which is bound up with disconnected economic struggles in a peaceful period, leads only too easily amongst trade union officials to bureaucratism and a certain narrowness of outlook. Both, however, express themselves in a whole series of tendencies which may be fateful in the highest degree for the future of the trade union movement. There is, first of all, the overvaluation of the organization, which from a means has gradually been changed into an end itself, a precious thing to which the interests of the struggles should be subordinated. From this also comes the openly admitted need for peace, which shrinks from great risks and presumed dangers to the stability of the trade unions. End quote. This explains why workers of different unions experience the same things from their leaders: a reluctance to risk the organization in serious confrontations with employers, the tendency to prefer peaceful negotiation over a strike, the preference for limited strikes over bigger, more general confrontations. In many cases, Union officials become so separated from the rank and file, so bloated with high salaries, and so accustomed to hobnobbing with employers, that they are incapable of defending their own members. This doesn't mean that union leaders can't or won't fight. Caught between the interests of the rank and file and the employers, union leaders are sometimes forced to lead battles simply to defend their organization. But by inclination, they lean towards organizational conservatism, trying to harmonize the interests of labor and capital. The American trade union officialdom, wrote Debs, quote, are at once the leaders of labor and the lieutenants of capital, and who, in their dual role, find it more and more difficult to harmonize the conflicting interests of the class of whom they are the leaders and the class of whom they are the lieutenants. End quote. Unions, more often than not, tend to reinforce the separation between economic struggle and political struggle. Particularly in the United States, pure and simple unionism, which focuses only on economic issues, is rife. The strongest weapon of the unions, the strike, is reserved for economic issues, and even then is resorted to only reluctantly. Walkouts that make political demands on the government, for a shorter workday, against child labor, to oppose a war, are practically non-existent. Instead, politics is typically restricted to union leaders mobilizing their members to vote for a bourgeois candidate. These shortcomings in the U.S. labor movement have weakened and thinned its ranks in the teeth of employer attacks, so that today the majority of workers are not members of unions. As in the 1930s, mass unionizing drives from below will be a necessary development in the reemergence of workers' struggle. Two of the most important questions for the workers' movement, therefore, are 1. How can it move past the limitations of its own trade union leadership whenever the latter betrays workers' real interests? And 2. How can the working class overcome sectionalism, the splitting up of workers into separate parts on the basis of different wage levels, skill, industry, and trade, and develop forms of organization that mobilize and unite the working class as a whole? Unless workers are united as a class, they cannot challenge the system. The role of socialists in the unions and in workplaces flows from this analysis. First, socialists support and promote the building of unions as elementary organizations of struggle. Second, socialists promote union democracy and shop floor representation as the best means of mobilizing the real power of the unions, their rank and file. Third, socialists support union officials who are more willing to fight, while understanding that the nature of unions puts limits on how far these officials will go. Fourth, socialists have to build the confidence and organization of the rank and file to act, if necessary, independently of union officials. Finally, socialists need to organize groups of rank and file militants in various workplaces who are capable of linking together workers in different industries and struggles, so they can move from separate battles toward class-wide confrontations and, ultimately, to challenging the system as a whole. End of section.